So today, I want to finish looking at the big picture overview of Genesis 1 and see what we can learn about it, just by how it's organized and how the author points us to the major point of the chapter. I'll introduce a new tool to help us in that effort. And I want to look at a story in the book of Numbers about a seer named Balaam. I guess that's the way you pronounce his name. That's what I'm used to saying, so I'm not going to try and change it. He's found in a number of parts of the Bible, so I think it's a good story to know. But it also illustrates our new tool. You know, in a lot of ways, easier than seeing it in Genesis. So then I want to look at Genesis 1 in a way that it's been seen to be organized, that I think was originally noticed in around 400 AD by St. Augustine, or Augustine, you know, one of the dominant early church fathers whose insights and publications have had such an impact throughout history. And then we'll look at each of the 6 days in a little more detail to see the five-step process God uses for creation. And finally, depending on how much we discuss, I want to turn to verse 1. At least I'm prepared to turn to verse 1. If we don't get to it this week, we'll definitely next week start looking at the chapter verse by verse. And when I do that, I want to again start bringing in other verses everywhere in the Bible that relate to those same verses. Like we did when we talked about the creation of the universe and the expansion of the universe. And I actually did not call that a tool, but I put that as tool one on your paper because it's what I used. Basically, you want to look at all of the scriptures on a subject and then come to your conclusions. And remember that truth doesn't contradict truth. So if two scriptures appear to contradict each other, or if you have an opinion and a verse seems to contradict it, you got to figure out how that all works. I can tell you my own experience, every time I think I found a contradiction, it's that I didn't understand one verse or the or the other. So I think that's the experience. And you know, I had a question a few weeks ago when we were talking about the expansion. I said God was controlling the expansion rate, fine-tuning it. You know, that, and that's my opinion. But I gave you all the verses, and you can look at it yourself and see if you come to that same opinion. The only caveat is make sure your, well, two caveats. Make sure your opinion doesn't contradict one of those scriptures, right? That would tell you maybe you're off track. And the second thing is if you're talking to someone about, you know, what your opinion is, you know, say, this might, you know, I think the Bible says this, but it's not clear about it. Don't equate your opinion with Scripture. Don't add to or take away from Scripture. So that's, I just put that down as a tool that we're going to use throughout the study. So I've copied Genesis 1 on page 3 of your notes. We talked last week about the use of an inclusion or inclusio, like bookends, to form the entire chapter. So Genesis 1:1 introduces the chapter with a generalized statement, and then Genesis 2:1 concludes the chapter with a one-sentence summation of the entire chapter. As someone in the class noted last week, we do the same thing in compositions today. You know, we'll have an introduction, a body with a lot of detail, and then a conclusion. We'll say what we're going to say, we'll say it, and then we'll say what we said. So, you know, we're familiar with this, we just may not have looked for it, you know, in the Bible. The second sentence of the chapter, found in verse 2, gives us the initial condition of the earth when God begins to bring order to the cosmos. And we'll go over that, and there's a lot packed into that little verse, and we'll spend most of next week on that. And you know, it's the same darkness, water, and chaos you'd see in a pagan account. But with my, you know, being trained to think as a scientist when I was young, I want to know, okay, they're starting in the same place as the pagan account, but what are those conditions? Did they really exist? And they did, basically. So we'll go through all of that next week. But what that verse tells us is the earth is without form and void. So completely formless and devoid. Void just means devoid of life. You know, it. It's chaotic and dead. It's lifeless and inhospitable to life. That's where God starts to bring order and create in this chapter. And this is where the Israelites would have expected it to begin. So they have some comfort. They're getting a whole lot of new information, but they can kind of relax and say, oh, so, you know, it's not just so radically different they couldn't relate to it, and they can absorb all the new content. And then day one starts in verse 3. And it ends with the sentence, and there was evening and there was morning one day. So notice that each of the 6 days ends with that same sentence. 2 days, three days. This is another mini inclusion or inclusio. Every day starts with, and God said, and it ends with that sentence. So Moses is using these within the chapter to break it into units of days and emphasize this by repetition. And I've skipped a line in between each of the days, so it's easier to see. And I use that version of the Bible because it's the one I had in Kindle, and I could copy and paste. So now, we've been told that the major point of Genesis 1 is the creation of man. And some people say we just read that into it because we want it to be all about us. Now, just imagine with me that you're watching everything in Genesis 1 happen. We're the angels with God in heaven applauding as he's doing all this, and we've got a video camera that we can speed up. You know how you can kind of see things happen fast with that time-lapse photography, and we can see them as they occur. So we'd start with utter blackness. I don't know if you've ever been down in the Blanchard Springs Caverns or in other caverns, and they turn out the light, you never experience blackness like that. That's what's described here. Just utter blackness. And then light appears, and you know, we're going along with our video, and you can see the earth as a water world. Then you have some separation of water in the atmosphere from water on the surface and the beginning of weather, and then dry land begins to appear above the surface of the water with all of its, you know, wonderful features. And then millions of plants begin to grow out of the land. All kinds of varieties. So the land becomes green. If you saw the movie Justice League recently, there was one scene where the bad guy was routed and all sorts of new plants were coming up. Everybody was just standing around watching that. So that's, you know, I imagine that's the reaction I would have imagined, you know. And so then the sky's clear. You can see the amazing things in the day and night sky, like the sun and stars and moon, and how fascinating that would be. And then God begins to create swarms of living creatures. Tons of species and tons of animals within each of those species. It's the earth just teems with life. In the water, and then millions of birds and all their variety. You know, I can sit in my backyard and watch just the little birds that come to my feeder for an hour. Just think how much more fascinating this would be. And then hundreds of thousands of living creatures abruptly appear on the land and all their numbers and variety. And we're fascinated by nature shows on TV. Just think how astounding this would be to see how this began. And finally, one man and one woman appear, and God stops creating. So after all of the wow factor of all of those previous days and everything we've seen up to this point, why would we imagine that the creation of humans is the most important event in God's plan, and he's bringing form and life to planet Earth? So visually, I don't think it would appear as a big deal if you just kind of think about that. But remember, the narrative accounts are meant to appeal to our emotions and our imagination, as well as our minds, our whole person. So when you just read Genesis 1, it really appears like humanity is the capstone. It's what it's all gearing towards. So just look at that page and see, and just kind of guess what features of how the story is told or things you might notice might give us that impression. You know, do you get the impression that the creation of man is the high point of the story? And maybe why do you think you sense that? And there's no wrong answer here. Just, it's just, what do you see? Anything. Okay, created in his image. Yes.
In his likeness.
In his likeness, uh-huh.
They rule over.
Okay. They rule over.
He's a lot more to say to them.
Okay. So you look at how long day six is. It's huge, right? Look at how long day one is. And the gee whiz wow factors, to me, were in the earlier days. But he didn't have much to say about them, right? Whole lot to say on day six. In fact, the first two lines are all about animals. Everything else is about man. So good. Anything else? Yeah.
He also gives some of the dialogue that's within the Trinity.
Okay. 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 Yeah. Right. That's unusual. You're right. Let us. The conversations. Yes. Okay. That's great. Yes.
He gets down and gets his hands in this one.
Okay.
He gets personally involved.
Right. Very invested. Right. You know, if you kind of just looked at those days and the space they take up like a triangle, it would kind of go like this with day six, you know, being very big. So,
it's a little like a play. Like all you're doing is watching the documentary of like the pre-production.
Uh-huh.
And not watching like that. Like you put it all together, but the whole point is that it is performed for an audience, right?
Uh-huh.
So, like, all of this is there, and then he stops creating, but the rest of the story continues. Like it's all about this last thing that he's created.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're just looking at the narrative creation, sure, like it could be easy to say, well, uh-huh, this is just one part.
Yeah.
What about all the rest of that story?
That's, yeah, good point. So, well, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So these are all clues that we just kind of absorb subconsciously, right? That lead us to this conclusion.
Yeah.
The tools that I'm sharing with you are really not meant to be used to diagram each Bible story, you know, like you had to diagram a sentence in school. But they're a way for you to check your intuition or your feelings as you read the story, a way to see if the meaning that you believe you see in the story is the one that the author wants you to see. So I'm going to introduce a new tool. It's called climax or intensification. I've got the definition on page one of your notes. There's an escalation in the text, a sense of movement from lesser to greater intensity, a type of repetition of comparative events that binds text together, showing an earlier inferior type and its fulfillment in a later superior antitype. So it's not just a repeated pattern like a refrain, but a superior fulfillment generally that advances salvation history would be a common factor. So that really is a tool that the authors use. They really do put these things in there to give that day and the creation of man more weight. It's not our imagination, but you see how these tools can just... And these tools are not rocket science. They're almost things we sense subconsciously, right? But you'll begin to see them as we go along. So what we saw in the text with the elements of the story getting more and more detailed and so much space devoted to the creation of humanity, that's a deliberate device the authors used to create this reaction in us to get our attention. So when we see this being used, it, you know, it just confirms our impressions. Or let's say you thought the main part of the story was some of the gee whiz stuff that I talked about, you know, like the appearance of light. This tool would lead us to believe, yeah, you're probably mistaken about that, but more likely that wouldn't be our impression, because just the way it's written just guides us to have the reaction the author wants us to have. So, let me give you an example of this technique of intensification from elsewhere in the Bible, and then we'll look for intensification or climax in Genesis 1. We find this technique used in the narrative of Balaam and his donkey, and that takes up three whole chapters in Numbers 22, 23, and 24. I've put the verses down everywhere Balaam is mentioned on the bottom of your notes. And because the account's so long, I'm going to summarize most of it and read a few parts word for word, mainly the dialogue, because the meat's in the dialogue. So, Israel, just to put it in context, is on the way to the promised land. They're camped in the plains of Moab, which is in Jordan today, across the Jordan from Jericho, and they're going to stay there a while. And we're told that the Moabite king named Balak knew that Israel had defeated the Amorites and took their land, and it says he could see the Israelites were very numerous, so it says he was exceedingly afraid of them. So he did two things. You remember Moab came from Lot's two daughters after Sodom and Gomorrah. One of the daughters had a child, and they became the Moabites. So they started out in incest, but from Abraham's family. And the Israelites weren't attacking them or conquering their land or anything. They were just kind of camped there. But the king first sought an alliance with the people called the Midianites to the east. And then he sent messengers to a man named Balaam, who was a seer. Now, Balaam lived almost 400 miles away in a day when you walked or rode a burden of some kind. And he asked him to come and curse Israel so that the king of Moab could defeat them in battle. So I think we can assume Balaam was the greatest spiritualist, you know, that the king of Moab knew he was, if he lived today, he might have his own TV show. as a seer. In fact, there are inscriptions in temples in the area where he was that have his name on it and some of his prophecies. So he's a big deal, right? He's not one of God's people. You know, he's from an ungodly area. The text points out that the messengers had the diviner's fee in their hands. So they were going to pay him to make this 400-mile return journey and curse Israel. And but Balaam says, you know, I better seek God's guidance on this. Actually, the word for God in this chapter is Elohim, which is not the covenant name for God of Yahweh. So he knew of God. No indication he was really one of God's people. And God appeared to Balaam in a dream and told him not to go with them or curse Israel. So Balaam told the men the next morning the dream and sent them away, saying God had refused to give him permission to go. But the king of Moab maybe thought this was just a negotiating technique, right, for more money. And so he came back to him with more men and more money. And Balaam again said, let me think about this overnight. Now, when I read the Bible, I often come across things that make me go, you know, things that just don't make sense. And I wonder why it's happening. And so then you go back and see if you can, because remember, they don't say anything that's not important. So you pay attention to exactly how things are worded. But it seems pretty clear to me from the first of the story that God told Balaam two things. And let me quote God here, what he said to Balaam in the dream the first time. You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. No wiggle room to me in that. That's the direct will of God for Balaam. Don't go, don't curse. But when the king comes back with more money, you know, to see if he could persuade him, the money's emphasized because Balaam answers them and say, though Balak were to give his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the words of the Lord my God to do less or more. Now therefore, please stay here tonight that I may know what more the Lord will say to me. And that is something else that makes me go, God had already spoken clearly. Why does Balaam want to hear a second word from God? What's changed? Well, there's more money. That's really the only thing, right, that's changed. So, so maybe he's, yeah, so maybe he sees this as a negotiating tactic. Maybe that's what it really was, right? He doesn't rebuke him for offering more money, you know. So, and again, it makes me wonder. At the very least, Balaam must have been hoping God would change his mind and permit him to go. So this is where looking elsewhere in the Bible can help. And Jude 11, we have a reference to this guy Balaam, and it says, "Woe to them, for they've gone in the way of Cain," and then this is the part I'm getting to, "have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit." So yeah, this is his issue, right? He's wanting the money. In other places in the Bible, Balaam is also given as an example of deceit and covetousness, and you see a lot of references to him. So he's a man who hires himself to do religious work for personal gain, and that way is contrasted with the right way. So he asks the men to wait. God speaks to him a second time in a dream. And this time he says, "If the men come to call you, rise and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do." So God does let him go, even though that was not his perfect will expressed earlier. And so again, that makes me wonder why. You could say that this is an example of God's permissive will. He's going to allow him to go. The next morning, the text makes a point of Balaam not waiting for the men to call him as God has instructed. He just saddled his donkey and went. So that makes him look eager, not reluctant, and he's not following God's instructions to the letter. And the big instruction is don't curse Israel, right? I mean, that's what God's, this is not God's plan. The verse actually says God's anger was aroused because he went. And that made me wonder why, if he was allowing him to go. And that's why I went back and said, okay, what wasn't right here? What did Balaam do? So perhaps because he didn't follow God's instructions to wait when they called him. And we know, because the narrator tells us, and Balaam doesn't, that he's under God's judgment, or maybe he's on probation, because we're told God's angry. Anyway, on his journey, an angel with a drawn sword blocks a narrow Balaam's way in the road, and his donkey saw it, and Balaam didn't. So the donkey turned aside and went into a field. So, and there are three occurrences of this same incident, and we're going to see this escalation or intensification in this incident. First, the ass shies away from the sword brandishing angel. Balaam can't see. Then he squeezes Balaam against a fence and crushes his foot against the wall. And finally, the ass simply lies down under him. So see how it intensifies and gets worse each. And each time, Balaam beats the donkey and turns her back into the road. Eat the poor little donkey. The third time, it says he begins to beat her furiously, loses his temper, and wishes he could kill her when she laid down. And then it says the Lord opens up her mouth and the donkey complains. "What have I done to you that you should have beaten me these three times?" The author makes a point of calling our attention to the three times. And you're going to hear this. It's that repeated word. You're going to hear this, you know, bringing our attention to that. Because the number is going to be important in the second half of the story. And, you know, I don't know if you're like me, but I'm wondering if the donkey really talked. Or if Balaam just understood him the way I understand my dog when she gets that sad eye dog look and whines, you know, when it's dinner time. And we don't know the answer to that. I wish I did, but we just don't. It would distract us from the main point of the story, so we're not let off topic. I kind of think, and I'll show you the verse where I think she probably had a voice. And then only when God chooses finally to reveal to Balaam the armed angel standing in the way does the irate seer repent for ill-treating the poor creature who frankly saved his life, because the angel says to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I've come out to stand against you because your way is perverse before me. The donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would also have killed you by now and let her live." So his life was in danger. The picture we have here is that Balaam, the world famous seer, is less spiritually perceptive than an ass. Right? And by the way, it's a female ass. which would have been a lower caste in that culture too. You know, so it seems fairly clear the ass in this episode plays the role of Balaam. He's going to behold divine visions with eyes unveiled to this Moabite king, Balak. So we're meant to compare Balaam to an ass. And so then Balaam is scared by the angel, and what he says and he offers to turn back, but the angel said, "Go with the men, but only the word I speak to you, that you shall speak." So Balaam's been warned to be faithful in what he speaks in a really dramatic way. Then the parallel between the two halves of the story, Balaam comes to the king of Moab. They go through all this elaborate divining thing. And Balaam makes three symmetrically arranged prophecies. Three occurrences of the same incident, each time escalating with greater discomfort to the Moab king, Balak. In Balaam's prophetic imagery, instead of cursing Israel, he blesses them. First, Israel is spread out like dust. Then Israel is crouched like a lion. And finally, they rise like a star. So the Moabite king is just progressively reduced to impotent fury, just like Balaam was at the donkey. Balaam said, became angry and threatened to kill the donkey only after the ass had made a fool of the prophet three times. And the Moabite king is said to become angry after the prophet had made a fool of him three times. So the repetition, escalation of events, it provokes wonder in providence and proclaims the message that Yahweh unveils the eyes of a prophet to see otherwise invisible God who rules history. Shows God can use even a pagan wizard to bring blessing to his people. You know, it's not the only time God uses an ungodly person to bless his people. You know, God's just intent on blessing his people, and he won't allow them to be cursed, even by the best diviner of the day. And Balaam's mentioned, as I said, a number of other times in the Bible. Let me read you what Peter says in 2 Peter 2:15 through 16, referring to Balaam. They have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he was rebuked for his iniquity, a dumb donkey speaking with a man's voice, restrained the madness of the prophet. So that's escalation and intensification. Mm-hmm. Y'all see that?
Yeah.
All right, so before we turn to Genesis 1, let me just satisfy your curiosity about what happens the end of the story. We learn in Numbers 31 that Balaam advised the king of Moab to use the Moabite and Midianite women to lure the Israelite men into sexual liaisons that would lead to idolatry. And it worked. Worked on a number of men. So it threatened Israel before they went into the promised land, and it brought God's judgment on Israel. There was a war, and Balaam was killed by Israel in the war when he was on his way home. So he didn't get to enjoy his money. So God's direct will for Balaam, you know, if he had followed that, he would have lived. He wouldn't have had the money, but he didn't get that anyway. He didn't live to enjoy the money. So that's the end of the story. But Balaam is used as an example, as you can see, even in Revelation, for one of the seven churches. All right, let's go back to Genesis 1. We see escalation, intensification in Genesis 1. We talked about a sense of movement from the lesser to the greater, as in day 6, and how much is said in that. We also see escalation in the verses devoted to each day. So day 1 has like 3 sentences, day 2 has 4, and then it jumps up. Day 3 has 7. And then it goes back down. Day 4 has, I think, 5, and day 5 has 5. So there's day 3 is emphasized, as well as day 6, because more is said of it. And then, of course, day 6 is the prominent one, because so much more is said about that. But And it's the capstone of all 6 days, but you can sense the movement and the escalation with each day just by how much is said about it, calling our attention to more and more detail as each event happens. And then days 3 and 6 are the longest day. So they emphasize something with, they indicate something with more emphasis. Now, Augustine meditated on this text and saw there are 2 triads of 3 days. And I've put that in a chart on page 2 of your notes. So the first triad ends with the land bringing forth vegetation. That's that third day that's longer. The second triad concludes with the creation of humanity. And this time mentions vegetation, but this time it's food. So remember this structure as to what happens on which days is almost identical to the ancient Near East. In the ancient Near East, the climactic moments are also the creation of vegetation and humanity, but humanity's role in those stories was to feed the gods and serve them. The message is that God creates humankind and prepares beforehand their sustenance. So what's happening here in these 2 sets of 3 escalating and intensifying days? Augustine saw the major point of the story was salvation, not the study of nature. And I put a quote from him in here. The Spirit of God who spoke through them did not choose to teach about the heavens to men, as it was no use for salvation. Mm-hmm. So he meditated. I mean, Augustine saw things in the Bible just by reading the Bible. He didn't have a lot of books and resources and commentaries like we do. He kind of wrote most of them. And he divided the 3 days based on the description of the earth's initial condition back in Genesis 1-2. It was formless and void, Genesis 1-2 says. And so see this chart on day 2. Now, we're not hearing this in ancient Hebrew, so we don't notice another kind of repetition that occurs sometimes, and that's repeated sounds. His listeners in ancient Hebrew, these 2 words would sound alike, so it would have caught their attention, tohu and bohu, which is kind of fun to say. Tohu and bohu. So tohu is formless, and bohu is dead. Right, is dead. No life, void.
And that means bohu. Tohu bohu. I think it's formless and void.
Yeah, that's formless and void. So the first day of each triad, look at day 1 and day 4. They both deal with light and luminaries. And the sky and the sea are parallel within fish and birds. And then dry land and vegetation are paired with land animals and humanity. So you can kind of see what people have seen looking at just the structure. Right. So some other observations about this pattern are that the first triad involves the separation of the formless, chaotic mass that we see in verse 2 into 3 static spheres. So the first triad gives form to the formless earth. The second triad, days 4, 5, and 6, fills up these spheres with moving forms. So the second triad overcomes the void, the lifeless state of early earth. And each triad, the creative work moves from heaven to water to earth. And each triad ends with the earth bringing forth, vegetation on day 3. And the second triad ends dramatically with the creation of God's man in God's image. Now, and both triads have the same structure. The first day of each triad contains a single creative act. The second day contains 1 creative act with 2 aspects. So the firmament divides the sea from the sky, and the creation of birds and fish to fill the sea and the sky. Each triad ends with 2 creative acts on the last day. So the culmination of the triads are shown with 2 creative words on day 3, land and vegetation, and 2 creative words on the 6th day, animals and man. The triads are also distinguished by escalating movement. The first 3 days are basically static until the end of day three, when you begin to see plants coming out of the earth. And by the way, plants are not called life in the Bible. It doesn't say they're not living, but the Bible's focused on living creatures with mind, will, emotions. And then the final 3 days show movement, you know, as living creatures are created. So everything is movement by the hand of God in days 4 through 6, not static. Note the parallelism between the creation of the static life support system and the creating of moving creatures to fill that static system. You know, animals have more degrees of movement than the sun and the moon, although the sun and the moon do move. And humanity has the greatest movement. So there's an intensification of movement as well. Genesis 1 peaks when humanity, created in God's image, is invested with dominion over the earth. As you said, verse 26 says man is to rule over the earth. Now, in the ancient myths of these days, the sun, moon, and stars are deities that rule the earth. Genesis doesn't even name them. You know, they're just a great big light and a smaller light up in the sky. And so that's one of the things that taught man from the Bible to think of creation as an it, not a thou. And notice the emphasis is on giving the sun and moon a role and a function. They're to separate day from night, be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. So I'm celebrating another you're around the rotation around the sun today, right? So the sun and the moon serve man rather than man serving them, as in the pagan myths. Okay, as I've said before, the image of God is male and female. Humanity is unity in diversity, and it really points to male and female several times. At the end of this verse. Now, reproduction is mentioned in the animal kingdom, but it doesn't mention anything about male and female. It's just reproduction. So it's really only, they're only mentioned with humanity to draw our attention to being image bearers. And in Genesis 1:1, the phrase heavens and earth, you read them together. Primarily God forming the earth and the cosmos in the first 3 days of creation. So the Genesis 1:1 really focuses, I guess, a bit more on those first 3 days. But in 2:1, the summary statement, when it says all their vast array, that's focusing primarily on the many, many forms of creation or creatures housed in these spheres, such as the luminaries in the heaven, birds in the sky, fish in the sea, and creepy crawlies, animals, and human beings on land. So, all right, so before I go on to the process of creation we see in here, let's just stop and see where we need some clarification or questions arising.
How did you say Augustine's
name? Well, it's either Augustine or Augustine. You hear it both ways.
Put him in context, like who he was, I forgot.
So he lived in a city called Hippo, which is in northern Africa. He was a bishop. He wrote Confessions, which is his most famous book, and it's kind of a story of how he became a Christian from a wild and crazy early life. And then he reflects a lot on time and creation and so forth at the end of the book. He also wrote City of God, and he wrote tons of other books. But both the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church point back to Augustine or Augustine for Orthodox belief. I mean, he was a teacher of rhetoric, which is speech. And so, you know, his writing is beautiful too.
About what century?
About 403, the late 300s to early 400s. Yeah, very early. He wasn't one of the earliest church fathers. He was kind of that next generation. But anyway, big deal in the history of Christianity. Anything else?
You notice in this repetition of, they're talking about vegetation or trees or anything, it's plants yielding seed. Always like, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed.
Mm-hmm.
meat bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them. Plants yielding seed. Trees bearing fruit with seed in them. It's all about bearing seed.
So that's the repetition, and that's good catch there. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the themes of Genesis, seed is huge.
Yeah.
It's huge all the way through. You know, you're leading up to Abraham. You've got the promise seed in 3:5. You know, seed is a big deal. The other thing that's a big deal is land, you know, which is kind of the emphasis on days 3 and 6 is land. And so having the promised land and having a land for the people, those are continuing themes. And so it's a good example of repetition of words points you to, okay, this is an important concept, and you'll be clued in to watch for it as you read further. Yes.
The connection between,
Go ahead. No.
I was thinking the connection between vegetation and humanity is like, you know, God's command to be fruitful and fruit.
Yeah. Again, fruit. Yeah.
And then also like, I give you all of every tree which has fruit yielding seed, it should mm-hmm. be for you.
Yeah. And the word blessing has the connotation of being fruitful and expanding. So yeah.
You may have already covered this, so if you did, I'm sorry to bring it up again. But have you all gone over why the covenant? I don't remember. Is why Israel gets chosen? I don't remember why they're chosen and where that comes in. I mean, why are they the covenant?
Right. Well, it's not because they're a really great obedient people, right? In fact, they're just like the rest of us screw-ups, humans, right? But there's one verse that says, but they're really good at teaching their children and passing on the covenant. But what you see in Genesis is you'll see God dealing with all of humanity from Adam and Eve, and it ends up a mess. And then with murder being the number one cause of death and everybody thinking evil all the time. And then, so you see the flood, and then you see again God again dealing with all of humanity, and it again ends up in a mess with the Tower of Babel. You know, men won't follow God, just dealing with everybody, just. And so it points to the reason God had to find a faithful man and his seed and have a chosen people. And the covenant with Abraham said, I'm choosing you and I'm blessing you so that you can be a blessing to the nations. So it kind of points to the fact that God had to choose a person and a people to reach the nations. And we're the descendants of Abraham, right? The spiritual descendants of Abraham. The New Testament says that over and over. And we're to be a people to reach the nations. So it that's just God's plan and the way he decided it would best work, and we can see it didn't work the other way. So,
Abraham followed God?
Yeah. Abraham.
Chose him because of that.
Well, actually, if you look at Apostle Paul, he chose Abraham because Abraham believed. It was all about belief. Apostle Paul says a whole bunch about that. It wasn't that Abraham was all that obedient. He did some squirrely things too, right? He took two steps forward and one step back a lot. Even right after he was called, he said, don't take your family. He took his family. Go to the promised land. He stops in Haran and stays there for a while. So Abraham, the reason he's the father of our faith is his belief. And again, that they pass it on to the children. So we're out of time. So we'll start next week the process of creation, which will be pretty quick. So we'll still be looking at the big overview in terms of that. Then we'll jump into verse 1 and 2 and go forward.